Hello and welcome to this experiment in teaching and learning tabletop role-playing games. I'm Thomas Manuel, and today isn't your typical episode on the Yes Indeed podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Ray Najadi, game designer extraordinaire, to learn how to play his game Apocalypse Keys, which was published by Evil Hat in 2022. This episode began as a post on the Indie RPG newsletter about how a lot of people primarily seem to learn games by being taught them. My hypothesis is that lots of people prefer to be players first so that they can learn the game from a GM, directly from a person. And I think they prefer to have the game taught to them before they even open the rule book for the first time. And I think with the rise of actual play streams or tabletop RPGs, I think a lot of people have started using these streams to learn games. But often actual play is incentivized to edit out a lot of the stuff that would make it a more effective teaching tool. Character creation, game setup, rules explanations, and all of that stuff. So I thought, what if I recorded someone teaching the game? It would be not the same, but a similar experience to having a GM teach you the game as you sit down to play it for the first time at a table. I think this could be useful to GMs who are going to run the game for the first time. It might help them with how to learn it and how to teach it. It could be useful for players who want to learn the game ahead of time, or trying to walk into their first session a bit more prepared. And generally with the newsletter, with this podcast, with almost everything I do, my goal is to kind of spread this hobby that brings me so much joy and fun. And I want to help new players access it. Does this kind of content help people with that? I am genuinely interested to find out. If you have thoughts one way or the other, you can reach me at notrueindian@outlook.com or on Twitter, Mastodon, Tumblr, or you could whisper to yourself in a dark room on a moonlit night. That usually works as well. More often than people think. Now, seriously, tell me what you think of this thing. Is it a good idea? Do you think it will work? I'm only able to do this experiment because of a grant from Diversity Saves, an organization that supports underrepresented voices in the tabletop space. You can learn more about them at diversitysaves.org. I'll have a link in the show notes. Also, before we get into the episode, here's a brief guide to its contents. The final edited version of this episode runs for about 1.5 hours. You could, of course, listen to the whole thing from start to finish. But if you don't want to do that, I will describe a little bit of the structure, and then you can use the chapter markers or the timestamp in the show notes to skip back and forth to the parts you're interested in. We begin with an introduction to the game, why you might be interested in playing it. It's basically a pitch to see if the game is for you. In this section, Ray also talks about safety tools and content warnings for the game a little bit. Then we get into character creation, where you make a character, and Ray explains to me what everything on my character sheet or playbook in this situation means. So if you're a GM, you'd probably have to do this exact thing for your players. And then in the middle of character creation, we take a break for Ray to explain to me the basic mechanics of Apocalypse Keys, how we roll dice for the game. And then once I have that information, I'm able to fill up more of the character sheet. So this again might be something that you would do in the same way for your players. After that, Ray teaches me the basic moves, which are the main things the characters will be doing in the game. If this is your first time playing a game that is PBTA, or Powered by the Apocalypse, as they're called, I link some resources in the show notes that will help you get started with the very basic fundamentals. But for this episode, just because we didn't want to make it too long, it kind of assumes that you've picked up on the basics already before listening to this. After that, we cover conditions, ruin, bonds, and end of session questions, which are all game terms that players need to know before they start playing their first session. Then we briefly talk about what you might do in your first session after you make characters. Basically, you flesh out a little bit of the setting before you start playing properly. And then in the final section, we talk about the pre-written mysteries that come with Apocalypse Keys. These are adventures with characters, locations, a weird mystery for the players to solve, and advice for how to run them as a GM. Well, I hope that helps you navigate this episode. So yeah, with that out of the way, let's get into learning Apocalypse Keys.
Okay, so today we have the pleasure, am I allowed to say that, of playing Apocalypse Keys. I think it's a pretty cool game. I am a little biased. Yeah, and so to talk you through the game, we should definitely sit down and talk through cats first. So when we say cats, we mean the concept of the game, the aim of the game, the tone, and our subject matter. And so to start off with, the concept of Apocalypse Keys is the apocalypse is nigh, and to fight monsters, we must be monsters. So this is a TTRPG about a group of Omen-class monsters who work for the Department of Interdimensional Vigilance and International Security Interdisciplinary Operations Network, otherwise known as Division. So Division is a mysterious organization dedicated to understanding the occult, taming the supernatural, and protecting the world. A world that is built for the mundane and for humans. A world that tries to pretend that monsters are not real. So in Apocalypse Keys, it's a game of emotional connection, complicated relationships, unpredictable mysteries, larger-than-life apocalyptical threats, and the brightest hope in the darkest despair. So we are monsters who are bound by fate, love, and power. So when we play Apocalypse Keys, there are a few huge themes to keep in mind. The first one is we are forestalling the apocalypse, right? So we are up against Harbinger-class monsters, right? These Harbingers that orchestrate horrors from behind the scenes. They are covering their tracks, unfolding their plans of terror and destruction. They manipulate monsters and humans to serve their goals and open these ancient doors of power. These are going to be very important. We'll talk about them a little bit later. And you are all that stands between the Harbingers in this world, between survival and apocalypse. And the second theme is we are solving mysteries. And as agents of Division, we must use our unique supernatural powers to unearth secrets. We gather clues and study the signs, which are called Keys of the Apocalypse. It's kind of a title drop. So when you are ready to confront the truth, you try to unlock Doom's door and see what lies on the other side. So can you get to that ancient door of power and can you unlock it before time runs out? But this is also a game where you're wrestling with power. Unlike other games that you might be used to, you don't start at a low level of power and slowly build your way up. You are already powerful from the beginning. So it's very possible in this game for your power to overwhelm you, for you to go too far. And of course, this is a game of emotional entanglements, because what does it mean when you go too far? It usually means that you are hurting someone important to you. Your relationships mean everything. You create bonds with each other as a means of controlling your powers, making sure you don't go too far. And last but not least, the biggest theme is your power will likely lead to your ruin. You are each tied to the demands of darkness, and in turn, you're bound to the terrible fate that awaits you. It may be prophecy, consequence, enemies more powerful than you, or simply the truth of your nature. When you look at the harbinger of the apocalypse, you know that many of your future paths lead to becoming one of them. The only thing standing between you and despair is your force of will and the positive relationships you have with others. But before we fall into the abyss, our aim for this first session will be creating our characters, establishing a few important details of the Division. If time permits, we'll start at the mysteries prologue. We'll debrief and have stars and wishes at the end of the session. So in future sessions, we'll go straight into the mystery and uncover as many keys as we can and hopefully track down the door of ancient power before the Harbinger claims it. So in terms of tone, I would like to give our content notes. The game deals with mature themes such as the end of the world, which we discussed a lot, supernatural forces and the occult. Some concepts lean into experiences that may find parallel with racism and marginalization. So you are encouraged to change aspects of the game to improve your enjoyment of the game, but it's also okay to not play this game. It's an important thing. So I do recommend that, my dear players, you take a look at things, and if you ever change your mind, it's totally okay for us to play something else or to tweak things to our liking. And there will be a lot of mystery, horror, and a focus on investigation. And many of the mechanics focus on relationships and romance, so this is something to keep in mind. If you want your character to opt out of romantic entanglements with NPCs or PCs or both, just let us know. And the tone can be very dark since we're dealing with these really serious themes, but the game at its heart focuses on hope, right? So if things get too intense for us, we'll use our safety tools to move into a different direction. I think I want to take a pause here to discuss briefly what safety tools are, in that they are a means of communication. They're a way for us to check in with each other before we start the game and after. So there's a built-in one with Apocalypse Keys. It's called Green, Yellow, and Red. You can find it in the book on page 13. So basically, we create a list of topics that we want to see in the game, that we maybe don't want to see in the game, and definitely don't want to see in the game. So with green, what themes, stories, and ideas are we excited to explore in this game? And in yellow, what themes, stories, and ideas do we want to see less of? So this is fine if it's like in small doses, it happens off screen, or we keep details to a minimum. And red is what absolutely will we not see in the game, no matter what, right? And so by establishing these early on, before the game starts, we have a good idea of how to keep people comfortable, how to have them focus on the fun of the game, because they don't have to worry about, you know, they can worry about the apocalypse, but maybe there are other things they don't want to worry about so much showing up in the game, right? And of course, this means it's a living document. You can update it at any time during the game, in between games. So it's important to check in with your players. And yeah, that's a safety tool that's built into Apocalypse Keys. You can look up other safety tools, see what works for you, but that's the one that comes with Apocalypse Keys, so you can try it out if you like.
Okay, Thomas here, interrupting from the editor's chair. If you're listening to this to learn, opening up the playbook, specifically the one called The Summon, would probably be for the best, because then you can follow along as I work my way through it. Also, if you're a GM, one thing to note while you're listening to the next section is how Ray asked me a bunch of questions, fleshing out my answers, prompting me to think about things as we go through character creation. If you're going to be the GM, this is a great skill to have, because facilitating character creation doesn't just mean explaining the rules. You're also GMing, and a lot of GMing is just being excited about these characters and asking questions and then reacting to your players' answers and incorporating that into the game and the story. Okay, going back to Thomas from the recording. Nice. Okay, that was the intro to Apocalypse Keys. I know what the game's about. I know where monsters fighting monsters. I know where we're working for a shady organization. I know we're trying to save the world. I know we're going to solve mysteries. So how do we make a character? Yeah, I guess that's the next step.
Right, right. So when we make a character, I know that we're used to, in a lot of games, being like, okay, this is a game of monsters. There's a way for me to play a werewolf, a witch, or why do they all start with W? But, you know, we have specific monsters in mind. Apocalypse Keys is a little different in that you can play any kind of monster, but it just depends on like what story / narrative / emotional arc you want for them. So let's say you want to play a werewolf, right? You can play a werewolf that was summoned from another dimension, and so they're the summoned. Or you can play a werewolf who instead is on the verge of death, almost died, but has this complex relationship with death, and now they're the Shade. Or maybe you want to play the werewolf who's the last of their kind. Maybe there are no other werewolves anymore. There's no pack. They're the completely last one in all of the world, and so now they are the last, right? So there are different playbooks. I would recommend that you just scan through and see like which arc excites you, which emotional themes. But a good one I always recommend people try out if they're not sure, especially if they're new to narrative games, is to try out The Summoned, because The Summoned is your straightforward, I'm here to hit things and still have feelings about it playbook. So, and The Summoned struggles with the prophecy that is haunting them, and that can be a lot of fun to bring into play. So it's also why it's the first playbook in the book, because it's a recommended one to start with, right? So
I like the lines that are on the top of the playbook. I think if I read them, I get some sense of who these playbooks like represent. The Summoned says, "My power is blunt, aggressive, and demanding. My heart yearns to love and to be loved." And I think, yeah, that's cool. I get that. I can work with that. So this is a Hellboy-inspired game, and I guess The Summoned is kind of Hellboy in that sense. Someone from another dimension who's shown up here and could be, like you said, bring an apocalypse on their own later.
Yeah, exactly. And in general, each of our characters has a way of like becoming harbingers themselves, right? That's a huge component. But definitely The Summoned is entirely inspired by the Hellboy character, in the same way that The Surge is inspired by Liz Sherman, The Found is inspired by Abe Sapien, and so on and so forth. Though we have a few other characters for some of the other ones, but definitely very Hellboy inspired.
So I guess the first thing I do when I make a character is I pick a name, a look, an origin. Okay. So I see we have some pick lists here. Oh, wow. So we don't have actual names. We have suggestions. I'm supposed to pick one and then think about like what that kind of evokes in me.
The pick list is, it leads you towards building a strong sense of who your character is to start with, right? Like a lot of the pick list is meant to evoke ideas. So the name one is the first time you start thinking about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the last option. It says a name I need to live up to one day. So I'm gonna name my character Raj. And Raj means sort of king. So I guess that idea is that I'm supposed to at some point be a king of some kind. Will I be? Can I be?
Yeah. Wow, Thomas, you're such a strong player. A name immediately? I've never seen that skill before. This is my first time. Other people need hours. I'm so impressed.
Yeah, I did edit 10 minutes of me thinking about this. For sure, for sure. Okay. Now I need to pick a look, and it says choose 1 to 3. All right. Again, some really cool options here. I like trench coat. It's the first option, and I just like the imagery. Trench coat that hides most of my monstrous form. A part of my body is a weapon I'll never use. Whoa. That's also really cool. What if that was like my heart? And I could actually like make it, I don't know, explode or something. Like, I mean, that's why I wouldn't use it, because it's just, I guess it hurts me too much to use. It's just also me learning, leaning into the themes of this game, I guess.
I love it. I love it. It's so good.
And something that hints at my struggle to be human. Do you have an idea for this? Because I love the description, but nothing kind of pops into my head.
Yeah, so all of the playbooks actually have this as the last one for the look, right? Because like in a lot of these games, you have the last option is something of your own making or whatever you want to make up. But me as a kooky little designer, I'm like, remember, the theme of the game is you're struggling to be human. But in your case, I feel like, so you have your monstrous form, you have a heart that you can't show. I feel like it's got to be something about you trying to like blend in, right? You trying to appear more human, right?
Okay, this is maybe kind of jokey, but I think it fits with the theme of the thing. Like, I wear trousers, but I have a tail, and I just have to kind of keep the tail hidden. Like, there is
stuffed inside. Oh, I love that so much. That is so cute, though.
Okay. Origin. This is really cool. I love this list. Lots of interesting stuff here. Someone from hell. Someone from the grasp of a cosmic horror. From a nightmare realm. That will crown me ruler of a broken world. Okay. So what if I choose this one? Because I already said I might be a king of some kind. So what if I choose from a nightmare realm that will crown me ruler of a broken world?
So the question is our world the world that you have to break? Or do you eventually have to find another world and break it?
I was imagining that it was my world that was the broken world, that I have to go back and become, like, something happened that broke that world. Maybe it was, you know, again, this is the first thing I go to. Maybe it was my dad.
Oh, yeah, let's do it. Ooh, he, like, went too far, broke the world apart. That's why now it's a nightmare realm. So a nightmare realm, are we thinking, like, with your monstrous form, what comes to mind is, like, you're like a nightmarish creature yourself, but because it's from a broken world, was it once a world of dreams? Were you all like dream-like beings and now you all look like nightmares? Is that what's happening?
Okay, yeah. Maybe it was once a kind of idyllic realm. And again, this is an easy thing, but I'm a big fan of Graham Walmsley's advice to go with the obvious thing because it's not obvious to anybody else what's obvious to you. So I think something happened to my dad and he wanted to turn back time and make it stop, like, you know, fix it. And then in the search for that, like not coming to terms with that, he's somehow gone too far and broken the world.
Oh, I like that. That's very cool. Yeah.
So what would we do next? Or the prophecy that haunts you.
Yeah, so each playbook gets like a unique question. And the unique question for the summoned is about their prophecy. So which one are you drawn to?
Okay, cool. So there is a prophecy that was told to me or told about me to somebody else. I guess I can decide whether I know this prophecy or not.
Ooh, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Since we're talking about nightmares, I like the second one, which says, I take every nightmare that haunts humanity and paint a beautiful broken world from their fears.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe it's something like that world used to be the world from which people drew their dreams from, and now it's become the world that they draw their nightmares from. Yeah, maybe the idea is that the prophecy says that nightmares from that world are going to come into this world and things like that.
Yeah. Ooh, I kind of like the idea, like over time since you were born, right, more and more people were having more and more nightmares. And so when the prophecy comes to pass, there are no more dreams, right, to be had. Ooh.
Oh, yeah. And I can already tell with Division being some kind of shady organization that they have one of those like a file which is just a stack of papers and it's all like data about like people having nightmares. Some people are hooked up to machines.
Oh my gosh, they probably have like, they have like a room that's just dedicated to instruments measuring what's happening and they have their predictions about when the prophecy is going to come to pass. Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah. I guess it's a room I'm not allowed in, but we'll talk about that later. I guess I think I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, so the next thing I see on the playbook sheet, it says darkness, and it says I gain 2 to 4 darkness tokens when I, and there are some options there, and I also see powers of darkness and what the darkness demands of you. So what does that mean? Okay, it's me from the future, as Jeff Stormer would put it on Party of One. I'm interrupting once more to say that even as we're sitting down to do character creation, rules questions are going to come up. This is a feature, not a bug. In fact, by using character creation as a place to slowly drip feed the rules, you're probably going to have a better time than if you tried to explain all the mechanics up front. Just wanted to quickly throw that out there. Back to Ray.
There's a lot of darkness going on. Like in a lot of TTRPGs, right, we roll dice, and usually we're used to rolling our stats, right? So usually we have things like charisma or cool or whatever it is in different games. But here in Apocalypse Keys, you have darkness tokens, right? This represents your connection to your innate self. And mechanically, what it means is the more you connect to the emotional themes of your playbook, the more darkness tokens you pick up. So as the summoned, you gain 2 to 4 darkness tokens when you, 1, feel unloved or abandoned, 2, overreact with violence, and 3, ask someone to give me their best shot and not hold back. Very Hellboy. And 4, ask someone to love me and only ever me, specifically Hellboy from the films. And then the last one is embody a condition that affects me. We'll talk about conditions in a bit. But basically, it's up to you as a player, like as you play the character, like whenever you feel or do these things. And then it's 2 to 4 darkness tokens because the keeper, right, will ask you, like, for example, you'll say, you know what? I feel unloved or abandoned right now because I thought I was the leader on this mission and no one is asking me for my opinion. So I feel pretty unloved. And then I, as keeper, will ask you, but how unloved and abandoned are you feeling? Is it a matter of 2 or 4 darkness tokens? And it's like, oh, I'm just feeling a little abandoned right now. So I'll pick up 2. A good keeper will say, like, but you know, you felt like you had a really close connection to this other PC and they didn't ask for your opinion at all. Like, it doesn't matter. And you'll say, you know what? You're right. I'm going to pick up 4 tokens. Like, it's right. And so each token gives you a +1.
So I get to decide that completely. So I get to decide that.
It's always up to you. You always tell me when it happens. I also recommend, like, the first time you're playing, because it's a system most people aren't used to, it's okay to be like, oh, hey, earlier when you did this, I realized it probably triggered something and I should have picked up tokens from that time. I recommend totally doing that as you get the hang of it. But these are also built to, like, key off each other. Like, everybody else has different ways of gaining darkness tokens and they go off against each other all the time, right? So it's very easy to set them off once you lean into it or look out for it.
And I think it says here that if I have more than 5, then something happens. So I usually have less than 5.
So you usually have less than 5. As long as you have 5 at the end of a move, right? So the reason why that is because each darkness token gives you a +1 to the roll, right? So it encourages you to use the tokens if you pick them up. But once again, you want to be careful because if you go too far, the interesting thing about Apocalypse Keys compared to other games is you're trying to control your monstrous nature. So you're trying to hit a sweet spot, right? You're rolling 2d6 and you are trying to hit an 8 to 10, right? And an 8 to 10 is called a perfect hit, by the way. And if you go higher than 10, if you get an 11 plus, it's a disastrous success. So you're too much of a monster. Your powers of darkness take over. The move tells you what happens. But the alternative is also pretty bad. If you roll too low, if you roll a 7 minus, then things also are bad. So there's a lot of pressure to try to hit that sweet spot, basically. I feel very pressured when I play this game, like, when I'm rolling the dice.
So I get to decide how many darkness tokens I add. So every time I roll, I'm like, I want to add 2 or I want to add 3. And I could add all of them if I don't mind going, you know, overshooting.
You can add up to a maximum of 3. That's right. And you can spend 0, right? So you can, I've had people be like, I'm just going to go with just my 2d6 and that's fine, right? But yeah, you can spend at most 3 darkness tokens. So, and you also brought up your powers of darkness, right? So each playbook has a set of powers they can draw from, like your superpowers, basically, because you're playing dark comic book, you know, superheroes. And what your powers of darkness do is that they flavor how you use the basic moves in the game. We'll talk about that in a bit. And they also flavor, like, how you interact with the world. So, for example, why don't you pick 2? And I'll give you an example of how that shifts the game, right?
Okay, so I will pick Colossus Strength, because I think that's super easy. And I guess I know exactly what that means. So I'll pick the second one, which is just slightly harder, and you can help me out a little bit. I will pick Shadow Control. What does Shadow Control mean? Like, what could it mean?
Nice. So in play, I've seen people say that they can control other people's shadows, therefore controlling other people. I've seen other people say, like, oh, I can pull weapons from my shadow. These are really, like, open. Like, some of them are very straightforward, like Colossal Strength, but things like Shadow Control are very open to interpretation. I've seen another one where they say, like, I can turn the brightest day into the darkest nights, right? And... Right? It's very tempting. And so basically, because let's say you choose Colossal Strength and Shadow Control, what happens is I, as the Keeper, am reminded that what I tell you about the world is keyed into your powers of darkness. I can be like, oh yeah, you know that door? You can take it off its hinges without breaking a sweat. Like, this is easy for you. Or when you meet a character, I can say, they carry themselves with a lot of strength. Like, you can tell this is a fighter, right? You can tell that this is someone who can take the hits. And if, depending on how you want to, like, so what are you feeling about Shadow Control? Like, how do you want to interpret that specifically for your character from the options we've discussed?
I really like the ideas you gave, but just going back to my thing about dreams and nightmares, maybe I can trap people's shadows and maybe talk to them a little bit. Maybe I can interact with shadows in a way like it's a shadow of themselves, right?
Oh, like the worst aspect of themselves or the hidden aspect of themselves. Oh, that is so cool. That is so cool. Yeah. So with that, I would say it's something like when someone passes you by, you can hear whispers of their shadow, right? Like if you step close, I can tell you, oh yeah, you can hear her. She's saying like, all I need is a chance. I know I can take her out if I'm just given that chance, right? Like if you're familiar with the idea of perception checks, it's an automatic way to like, okay, this is how I communicate to the player and the way they see the world, the way they understand the world. And this is based on various things like your origins and stuff like that. But the powers of darkness is an easy way to remember, right? Like, okay, this is how the character interacts with the world and how they leverage control, right? How they affect the world too is also informed by your powers of darkness. So it's flavor that leads into mechanics, basically. And narrative effects, yeah.
All right. And what about what does the darkness demand of you?
Ooh, okay. So basically every one of our dear omens, because you're more powerful than the other monsters, it means that the darkness is calling out to you, right? This is the stuff that will lead you towards becoming a harbinger, basically, right? So you have to choose two, right? And some of these are more emotional, some of these are more like classic apocalypse harbinger stuff, right? So why didn't you pick two that interests you, and then we can like talk out how it affects the game and how it plays out?
So this is me picking something that I want to constantly kind of wrestle with the game.
Yes. So you're giving me permission as a keeper to be like, this is how I'm going to tempt you. Right. The best way to put it is that meme. I think most of my games are this meme of Princess Daisy leaning into Princess Peach being like, aren't you a little tired? Don't you want to go a little ape shit? Like, that's basically what this is.
Nice. I like to betray those who love me most. I like that a lot. And I like... Ooh, okay. I like to fall in love with a harbinger of the apocalypse. I don't know what that means. You know, I don't know why the darkness wants me to do it, but that sounds cool.
Yeah. So basically with those two things, what it would, and it's up to each keeper, right? Like how they want to interpret it. But to me, with those two choices you make, it means I should make NPCs that love you, that are drawn to you, that want to support you. So you have every opportunity to betray them. And I also have to make hot harbingers that you want to fall in love with.
Oh, nice. Okay. That really read me like a book, though. May have revealed too much.
I mean, Apocalypse Keys is definitely the game where you go, oh, no, they're hot, right? That's kind of the... the vibe. This bad guy, this harbinger, oh no. These things also do directly feed into one of the basic moves, so maybe this is a good point where we can take a pause from character creation to take a look at the basic moves, right?
Yeah, I'm really interested in how I can have colossal strength, which should allow me to fix a lot of my monster-related problems, and how that's balanced out.
Totally, totally. It's never a problem to have colossal strength. It's always a good thing.
I mean, I can't see a single downside. I snap my chopsticks as I try to eat.
It's so true, though.
Okay, Thomas here interrupting once again. We've basically finished step two of the character creation process in the book. It's on page 85. And instead of going to step three, we're now kind of going on a little diversion to get into the basic moves. Now, a lot of this explanation is for the GMs in the audience who are going to run this game. If I was teaching the game for the first time, we might not really discuss basic moves at this point, or maybe at all in session zero. They can be explained as and when players do stuff that triggers them during your first session when you're actually playing. That's just an option. There are many ways to do this. If you do want to continue with the character creation process, then you can skip to the next chapter in this podcast. If you do want to learn about basic moves and are going to listen to this section now, it's probably useful again to have the rulebook open in front of you, because we don't read out the full text of the moves. We just kind of assume that people will have the text in front of them. Maybe that's not a good assumption. Something for me to think about later. The section starts at page 37. All right, back to Ray.
Okay, so basically with the basic moves, these are moves you can always do at any time. Any omen, any PC has access to these moves, and they represent like the core movement of the game, right? They represent like what you're doing as monsters investigating the apocalypse. So we have Unleash the Dark, Power Through Darkness, Reveal Your Heart, Torn Between, Grasp Keys, Unlock Doom's Door. So I'll just like briefly summarize each one, and we can look at some of them a little closer. So Unleash the Dark, this is when your powers of darkness can always come into play. You don't always have to use your powers of darkness, but it's the easiest one to use it for. So you use it to manipulate, intimidate, or harm another, right? And so the thing with moves is you want to hit the trigger, which is usually the first sentence. It's the action that you're taking in order to trigger the move. So when you unleash the dark within you to enforce your will on someone physically, socially, or emotionally, spend darkness tokens and roll. So in your case, my dear, right, you have colossal strength. I feel like it makes sense how that works physically, but even socially, right? You could be like, I'm going to tear off this door to intimidate this guy into telling me everything he knows, right? You could do that too. But you could do the same with your shadow control, right? You can be like, I know what you really want. I know what you really want to do, right? And so you just describe to me how that works. And then there's like a bunch of options to choose from, depending on how you want it to go.
Okay. So if I was to say something like in the game where I was like, I'm trying to talk to somebody, and I can say something like, I snap my finger and their shadow detaches from where it is and comes and like whispers something in my ear. If I say something like that, you'd be like, yeah, cool.
It happens. It totally happens. Yeah, yeah. In fact, it would even happen without you having to roll the dice. The only reason we roll the dice is to be like, does this work out like you want it to? Is the main question, right? There's a lot of permissions in a game like Apocalypse Keys. We roll the dice to be like, is it going to work out like you want it to? So with Unleash the Dark, specifically if the person can resist, right? Like if they're just a normal human that can't resist you, it just happens, right? But if they're a strong enough human, maybe they're helped by a harbinger, or if they're a strong monster themselves, then we definitely roll to see what happens, right? And so on an 8 to 10, you wield the darkness with control and ease. You get to choose two options from the list. on an 11 plus, your control falters and you go too far. You choose one, but the keeper describes an unintended consequence. So, you know, just because it's juicy, I'll probably describe that one. But on a 7 minus, you have greatly underestimated them. The keeper will describe the desperate position you find yourself in. So you can see how the move guides the narrative, right? And helps you understand what's going to happen in the next step. So let's say you roll an 11 plus, right? And you're using your shadow control exactly as you described in that juicy way. I would say that you still get to choose one, but I would say, and you can wait until like after they make the choice or before, right? I'll say that there's another shadow that you notice on top of the ceiling that like skitters across it, and it's moving quickly towards you. And before you can react, it jumps into your shadow. And you hear someone else's thoughts that you can't recognize whispering in your head. And they're going to be there for a while, right? That's the consequence. You called on someone that was drawn to your power, right? It found a nice home in your shadow. So that's Unleash the Dark, right? And then Power Through Darkness is basically, because you're powerful, we only use this move if you're really pushing it. Like if you tell me as a player that you're like, I want to control every shadow in the city, I'll be like, okay, buddy, we need to power through darkness. Like one or two people, sure. But like an entire city, I won't say no, but we have to roll for it, right? Is how it goes. And then the next basic move is reveal your heart, which is, you know, it's hard to be a monster. You go through a lot of stuff. And it's basically the easiest way to heal up, to recover, right? So this is probably where we're also going to talk about conditions. So in most TTRPGs, you have hit points, right? So this usually measures your exhaustion or how many wounds you can take. But in a game like Apocalypse Keys, where in your case, you are playing like a nightmare heir from a hell dimension who will rule a broken world, it doesn't matter so much like how many wounds you can take, right? Instead, it matters, can your heart hold out? So each playbook has a unique set of conditions. And as the summoned, yours in particular are raging, lovelorn, obsessed, and despairing, right? So if something happens and I tell you someone gets a hard hit in or there's a shocking revelation of some kind, then I say you have to mark a condition. You tell me which condition you mark. Like, I never tell you as the keeper which one you mark. And yeah, and so reveal your heart is one of the easiest ways to heal up on those conditions when you reach out and sincerely connect to someone, along with some other things. But basically, it's the best way we grow. It's the best way we heal is by revealing an aspect of yourself, being vulnerable to usually another PC, but it can be to an NPC too.
Okay. And getting a condition isn't a bad thing. If I picked I'm raging or something like that, like, and I play into raging, I can actually get darkness tokens because that's one of the things. So it's not a bad thing. It's just a facet of my character that is true now.
Yeah, yeah. And it's up to you how you embody that condition, right? Like you tell me. And if you don't want to embody that condition, you can mark it. And then you can decide as a player, you know what? I'm never going to, in this scene, embody it. That's fine, right? It's always up to you when the condition affects you, basically. It's another thing to draw from for your role play is how it goes. So that was reveal your heart. And then the reason why we got into basic moves is the juicy torn between. So this is an interesting move because you don't roll for it. So the triggers are when you are torn between your monstrous nature and your human heart, or when you are tempted by what the darkness demands of you, make a choice. So if I describe a really hot harbinger, right, who is exactly your type, let's say after we play for a few sessions, or because you're my dear friend Thomas and I know what's hot for you and your characters, I will specially craft an NPC for you. Or I could just ask you, I could ask you what makes this harbinger hot and you can tell me, right? Then I can ask, are you tempted by what the darkness demands of you? Are you falling in love with this harbinger? And, you know, you as a player can always tell me, Ray, they're not hot enough. You know, I'm not gonna... I'm not torn between in this moment. But you can be like, you know what? No, this is exactly it, Ray. Like, horns and glasses, you've got me, right? Like... That's me revealing myself. But anyways.
Any tiefling.
I love tieflings. Like, they're the best. Next to Dragonborn, right? But, you know. So, but yeah. And then so when that happens, you make a choice, right, about how this is expressed. Most notably, Torn Between also happens when you end a move with more than five tokens, more than five darkness tokens. Right. So that's not up for debate, unfortunately. Like if you have too many tokens, the darkness is like mounting up inside of you and you have to find a way to deal with it, basically.
So the options here are interesting. One of them says mark one ruin. I guess we'll get to that. But for the character, it's like a moment that could be leading them down this path to becoming a harbinger themselves.
Exactly, exactly. It's like that moment where Hellboy is tempted to become Amun-Ra, right? To become the prophecy, the king, right? So, but yeah, so it's definitely a moment for you to enjoy as a player. I guess like when you think about it in Apocalypse Keys, it's like, how much do I want my character to suffer and in what way, right? It's always up to you. You can enjoy the angst aspect of the game, right? But yeah, it's always like up to you exactly what that looks like. So yeah. And then the last two basic moves are about the mystery itself, right? So the next move is called Grasp Keys. Keys are basically clues, investigative signs of the apocalypse. We will dive more into what that looks like for you as a keeper, right, on the other side of things. But for your players, it's when they're like trying to figure out what's going on and then they uncover a key, right? And if they get enough keys, they can try to unlock Doom's door, right?
Yeah, I think it'd be good to go back to that example. So I wanted to talk to that shadow because I wanted some information from that person, right? And I assume I wanted that information because we're solving a mystery and I'm trying to get a clue, right?
So this is an interesting thing, right? So if you were playing and you're like, oh, I'm trying to intimidate this person, I'm using my shadow control to get information out of them. As a keeper, I could clarify, okay, are you just trying to get general information that'll help you later? Or do you specifically want to get a key? Right. It depends, right, on what your vibes are in the moment, in the scene. I could decide as a keeper, you know what, you're up against like it's a really difficult monster, so you're gonna have to unleash the dark first just to be able to get an opportunity to grasp a key. But I could also decide, you know what, why don't we skip to grasping a key? So a lot of these moves are always like intuitive, what feels best for the scene and the pacing. But let's say, you know, I was like, oh, this monster, like, he's going to be a tough nut to crack. Like, he's had people deal with his shadows and nightmares for centuries. So you're going to have to unleash the dark against him first. And you do it. You just have another, you know, shadow riding in your subconscious now. It's totally fine. But you choose one of the options, which can lead you, any one of them, honestly. But let's say expose a weakness or a flaw, right, is the option you choose from Unleash the Dark, so you have an opportunity for you or someone else to grasp keys, right? But let's say it's you again, right? So I explain to you, okay, so like you lean in, you get in the information from the shadow, and you hear their shadow whisper, the harbinger comes to me in what used to be my dreams, but now they're only nightmares. Right. And this is me being a little bit of a tease, being like, is this related to you? Like, are you behind this? Maybe. Is your dad the harbinger? We'll see. But my dear keepers, you don't have to go that hard. That's just Ray's style of doing things. So I say, like, you've got this clear opening, right? Like, what are you going to do to grasp the keys? So do you want to use more of your powers of darkness? Do you want to do something else? Like, what does it look like, right?
Okay. And then I might say that I grasp the shadow in my hands and say, tell me what you have to tell me, or something like that. And then we'd roll, and if I succeeded, I get a key, which is a clue, and you know, one of the pieces of the puzzle, as it were. And if I fail, it says I might not get a key and things might get worse. Cool. That's fun.
Ooh, but actually, what's interesting about this game is even on a miss, right? Even on a 7-, you find more than you were ready for. You may choose to mark ruins and cover a key anyway. But in doing so, the keeper will reveal how you come closer to becoming a harbinger. So let's say you rolled that miss, and let's say you mark that ruin, right? Bringing you closer to becoming a harbinger yourself. That's a track that we keep. It's a track that we have at Apocalypse Keys. And yeah, then I'll tell you, you grab the monster, right? And you feel the rage pouring out of you and into the shadow. And the shadow starts turning into this dark, murky red. And the shadow leans in and says, "You are exactly like your father. You will break this world like how he broke the last one. And I will give you like a particular key. But as a keeper, I will change it a little bit to connect it to your story a little more," right, is how it goes. So in Apocalypse Keys, no matter what, you can always get a key when you do this move. But you can choose for that not to happen, right? So once again, it's up to the player to be like, you know what? I'm okay with letting this key go. That's okay. That can happen. That's a thing. Yeah. So our last one is called Unlock Doom's Door. So this is like our high stakes move. So we've talked about how this is a mystery game, right? But what makes Apocalypse Keys different from a lot of mystery games, and this is inspired by the Carved by Brindlewood system, is that the mystery is not written in advance. So the keeper has a premise, right? They have keys to draw from, they have characters to look at, but there is no explanation for what is exactly going on, because you're playing like really larger than life characters that will bring in a lot of themes and a lot of ideas. So the keeper is encouraged to like bring those into the mystery. So because you're a character who's about nightmares and about a hellish dimension, I would probably bring in elements of that into the mystery somehow. But at some point, you're going to have to tell me what the truth is, right? So the trigger for this move is when you are ready to declare what the door is and how to unlock it, say what you believe it to be. So you connect the keys to the facets of the mystery. So each mystery comes with like particular facets, like ideas that you have to keep track of. But once you describe how the key explains certain aspects of the truth, revealing the harbinger. So this is when you roll and you add the number of connected keys minus the mystery's complexity. So this is a roll that cannot be affected by darkness tokens, bonds, or any other mechanic, any other move. It's do or die by this one roll, basically. Depending on how complex a mystery is, that's how many more keys you have to pick up to compensate for it. So in an 8 to 10, that's sweet spot. You track down the door, you know exactly where it is, how to unlock it. In addition, the keeper will present an opportunity to protect what matters most, take down the harbinger, or otherwise drive back the apocalypse. On an 11 plus, which can happen if you wait too long and you've picked up too many keys or you just roll too high. Sometimes it happens, right? You reach the door moments after the harbinger has unlocked it. And that's actually what you see in the cover of Apocalypse Keys of the book, is an 11 plus happening. So they've begun to harness the power on the other side of the door, but there is still time to stop them. The keeper will tell you what sacrifice or risk you will need to endure to interrupt their ascension. And 7- is a painful one. The door remains hidden. The theory was the wrong one. Every PC marks one ruin. In addition, precious time is lost and a doomsday clock ticks forward. If this feels the doomsday clock, the harbinger has claimed the power of the door and the PCs will face the worst possible circumstances. So it's a very high stakes move. It is definitely the climax of the mystery, depending on how the roll goes, right?
So, okay, at this moment, we've gone through the mystery. We all have our theories. We're like discussing it. We connect all the keys up, all the clues together, and then we voice the theory and then we roll. And if we miss and we roll a 7-, that means, okay, cool. Like we're all a little bit closer to becoming harbingers ourselves, but we get to potentially just rejig the theory and try again. Maybe we might look for another clue to just give ourselves that extra plus one.
Yeah. a little extra boost. Yes. 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 Exactly. Exactly.
Makes sense. I'm seeing how everything kind of like fits together. I think this whole like, you know, you get to decide what the mystery is something that people will kind of have to feel their way through. Like I can imagine some people just like getting, okay, awesome, cool. So we're making this up together. Awesome. Let's do it. And I imagine some people going like, oh, no. Somebody needs to know exactly what is going on and for the mystery to be like concrete and like predefined and stuff like that. And they might not like it. I guess that's fine. I mean, all the other games that came before this one did it like that. So, you know, there are other games to play.
Because essentially something to remember is that Powered by the Apocalypse, the engine is usually built around the idea of playing to find out. And to some extent, we could say that every game is playing to find out. But like Powered by Apocalypse is like really leans into that. And so having a mystery where you also play to find out is, you know, but the funny thing is, I'm obviously a little biased because I made the game, but but in all the sessions we've had, even though everyone knows that they're quotation mark making it up, it feels so real. And this is based on my personal experience of running other games where there is a solid mystery in place. And I always feel like the players come up with a better idea. And I sometimes have to lie and be like, yeah, that's totally, you totally got it, because their idea was way better. And I think part of it is because the players cannot help but center their characters and the themes that are important to them that someone who wrote the mystery disconnected from the players will not know or have access to. Anyway, I'm going to resist the design talk, right? But, you know.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm so glad that you said that because, yeah, I think a large part of these games is kind of taking a thing that you might be doing like smoke and mirrors around, like in another game. Like you wouldn't tell the players, hey, like you gave me that idea and that's why, because that would kind of rob them of their feeling of it's real or whatever. Here you're just like letting them know beforehand so that you don't have to play that trick.
Yeah, and it's so weird because like in the same way that the smoke and mirrors feels very real to the players coming up with it also feels very real. It's very strange. It's like the magic of storytelling. All right, so I'll say, so the best way to think about the basic moves in action is that they're all meant to feed into each other. And so they're also something to keep in mind if you're not sure what your players should be doing to move the mystery forward. They should be doing the basic moves. So the omens grasp keys to try to figure out what the ancient door of power is, how to open it, and what lies beyond it. That will usually lead to complications, resulting in PCs having to unleash the dark or power through darkness to confront antagonists or overcome challenges. And in doing so, a PC may find themselves torn between what they must do and what the darkness demands. In order to keep going, an omen must reveal their heart, seeking comfort and support in moments of intimacy and sincerity. And finally, when the PCs feel like they can use all the keys uncovered thus far, they may attempt to unlock Doom's door. Will their theory be correct, or will the doomsday clock tick forward? Right? So this is the basic cycle we have in mind, and all the other moves you have access to as players. I think a good way to think about it is that they can replace what some of these moves do. So instead of unleashing the dark, you could be, as the summoned, using your borrowed power to summon something else to deal with the problem for you, right? But the basic moves are like a good way to keep the mystery moving forward, to express your characters. And while different designers have different ideas of what the basic moves do, but for me, they're like the training wheels and the core movement of the game. And then once you get the hang of Apocalypse keys, you can start using the other moves to do similar things, because some of the other moves give you keys, some of the other moves give you other bonuses, though there's only one way to unlock Doom's door, right? And that is by that move. So
I guess in the first session, I might not look at my playbook moves at all, right? I might just focus on this stuff if I want to get a grasp on it, and then try to do my cool playbook specific moves later when I, yeah.
Because the thing with Apocalypse keys is that it is a complex game, and so it really will take time to master it, it's really okay to just engage with the basics of the game for the first few sessions as you feel it out. And I will say, as the keeper, you'll probably feel nervous about handling the mystery well. But don't worry, you can pretend it was all part of the plan and all the missing threads are opportunities in the future. So...
All right, editor slash interrupter Thomas here once again. There's a few things left to do in character creation. As per page 85, players now will pick their specific abilities. They pick one from their playbook, and then they can pick another one that is either a division move or a ruin move. What does that mean? Well, in this section, we'll discuss that a little bit, as well as discussing a bunch of other stuff that's on the character sheet. This means conditions, ruin, bonds, end of session questions, and stuff like that. Okay, so I have two questions, and they just come up because they keep being mentioned in the moves. One is conditions. Okay, like, you've told me what a condition is. Like, in some sense, this goes back to like a status condition in a video game, like I'm poisoned or whatever, but like, this is more emotional. I get that. But what happens if I get too many conditions? First quest.
Okay, so most of the playbooks, the Hungry is an exception, but most of the playbooks have four conditions, and when you mark all four, you hit your breaking point, right? So because you are a monster who is barely in control of their abilities, what the breaking point means is that you will become everybody else's problem, right? It is this huge narrative moment when you succumb to the worst aspects of yourself for just a moment, right? You just lose control for just a moment. So in the case of the summoned, but every character, right? Every PC reads out what their breaking point is. Yeah, there's a different one per PC. So for the summoned is, you know that this world is not your own and you will never belong here. The dream that is humanity can never belong to you. The darkness grips your heart and the world you were summoned from bleeds into this one. You are a beacon to what has been aching to reach this world. Describe what terrors are unleashed. So this is what the player does, right? So the player tells me, you tell me, describe what terrors are unleashed and how an aspect of your terrible prophecy comes to pass. The keeper will tell you how the world is now wounded, warped by what you allow to come through, right? So you tell me how bad it is and I make it worse, basically, is how it goes. So what the breaking point means is that the whole thing, the whole story, the scene becomes overwhelmed by what's going on with the PC and we are forced to resolve it. It can take like a single action. It can take a whole scene depending on how things goes. But at the end of it, after your breaking point, you clear all your conditions, but you mark ruin. Right. So I think we're going to talk about ruin next then, right? Because that leads.
That was my next question. For sure, the word is very evocative. I'm sure it's really bad when I mark all my ruin or whatever. But
yeah. So like what we talked about, you are Omen class monsters. And the only difference between an Omen class monster and a Harbinger class monster is a Harbinger has given themselves completely up to ruin. They are completely dedicated to what the darkness demands of them, right? They are not holding themselves back. They're not trying to protect humanity, right? They are full Princess Daisy mode, right? Just going apeshit, right? So basically, you're used to having an XP track, right? A track that marks experience. In Apocalypse Keys, you have another track called a Ruin track. And it takes longer to level up. Like, it takes 8 marks of XP to level up, but for ruin you only need 5 marks of ruin in order to like fill that advance, right? And so when you advance your ruin track, you have certain options. You get access to ruin moves, which are really powerful because we've been talking about the rolls and how it's hard to hit the middle ground. But in a ruin move, you never roll. You always just mark more ruin depending on how much control you want, and things go your way. You don't have to pray to the dice gods, right? So these are powerful moves. So for example, the summoned has one called the prodigal child will return, where you can just ask your true parent or creator, your dad who you brought up, right? Could be this character depending, and you just tell them to do what you want them to do, they will just do it, right? Depending on how much ruin you mark in exchange for it. So yeah, so every playbook has access to these powerful ruin moves. With the ruin advances, you can also pick up ruin moves from other playbooks. But the thing is, after a while, you start running out of ruin advances. And one of the options, though you can take this from the beginning, I've seen people do it, but theoretically, if you move through all of the ruin advances, the last one is you become a harbinger yourself, right? So you become more powerful. And there are other things that can happen with the ruin advances, like you gain access to ruin conditions that you can also pick up tokens from, but represent how you're becoming a more darker, twisted, harbingery version of yourself, right?
Yeah. I get this. Like, so, you know, I might want to mark ruin in the beginning and get a cool new move. And then as I get closer to having to retire my character, I might want to really, really not get any more ruin.
Yeah. And so it's always up to the player, like how much they lean into their ruin and how much closer they come to being a harbinger. But I will say the moves are very tempting because it's nice when things just go your way, right? Just go a little apeshit on purpose. Another aspect of character creation is, aside from choosing one more of your playbook moves, you decide if you're going to start with a division move or a ruin move. And the choice alone communicates like how much of a good little monster you are, right? So are you more connected to division and its resources? The division moves are not connected to any playbook in particular, so anyone can pick them. And so, for example, you can have a Fey Liaison, or you can have a Ghostly Agent, or you can have a Holy Symbol Arsenal, which is a thing from Hellboy, so it survived in reference. So if you pick one of those division moves, they work like the other moves. You're trying to hit that sweet spot. Sometimes there's something other than darkness tokens, but you're still rolling on a scale of some kind, and you're still rolling dice. And if you choose one of the ruin moves, that means you're already one step closer to becoming a harbinger. You're closer to that aspect of yourself, basically. So that choice speaks a lot to the character. So you start off with an easy way to like get ruin and get more ruin moves, right? Versus if you start with a division move, it's a little slower to get the first ruin move. Yeah. So I personally, if you like to play like me and you want to power game a little bit, I recommend starting with a ruin move. But, you know, the division moves are really fun, too. I mean, I'm biased because I made them, but, you know, so. The last one we didn't cover is starting bonds, right? Basically, each playbook has three questions, and the first two connect you to other PCs, right? And, yeah, the reason why they're so important is because when you spend a bond on a roll, and this happens after you roll, they give you a +1 or a -1, right? So it's a good way to try to hit that sweet spot, right? So you start off with like a few bonds. You start off with 4, just so you can get used to how they feel in the game. And then there are opportunities to create more bonds, such as revealing your heart or other moves as well. But yeah, that's basically it in making a character.
Nice. Cool. I get bonds. I spend them to nudge a role to where I want it to be. That's very cool. I get the fiction also, which is that my friends are basically helping me out.
Yeah, because every time you spend a bond, you think of a moment of closeness you had, or maybe they're helping you in the moment right now. I will say you can also form bonds with what the darkness demands of you. So that's a little, that's a little bit of a tease there. But yeah, but yes.
Mm-hmm. And cool. I guess the only thing left is there is an XP track, and there are end of session questions and something called your impulse. Could you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the end of session, basically everyone answers these questions for themselves. It's a good way to like wind down and review what happened, because a lot can happen in a game of Apocalypse Keys, like any Powered by the Apocalypse game or narrative game, you can run through the beats so quickly that it's hard to remember what happened the next time. So the end of session is a built-in way to like review that. So the questions that everyone answers is, did you express your monstrous nature and or express your humanity? If yes, mark one XP, right? And so it's up to you what that means. Once again, this game is always up to you and your interpretation. What is monstrous? What is human? Usually they're the same thing. So on and so forth, right? The second question is, did you learn something significant about yourself and your impending ruin, right? And there are lots of guiding questions in the book for you to refer to in case these are not clear enough, but it becomes really clear in play. And the third one is, did you learn something significant about a fellow monster? This can include a PC, but it can also be an NPC. And that also marks one XP. But the last one for the end of session moves that everyone has is, did you uncover at least one key of the apocalypse or attempt to unlock Doom's door? If no, you mark one ruin. The narrative idea is like, maybe there's a part of you that wants this to happen, right? Maybe that's why you're not doing this. Right? The game is always like, maybe the apocalypse isn't a bad idea, like every once in a while. So those are the end of session questions that everyone has access to. But every playbook also has their impulse, which also serves as just like adding a question at the end of session, right? And it's a way to guide you into the different themes of your playbook. Some questions are more monstrous, some are more human, so it also helps guide you in play. So for example, the summoned ones, the impulse questions are, did you fight against a prophecy that haunts you? Did you learn something significant about your prophecy? Did you entangle another monster with your prophecy? Did you try to hold on to your humanity to great consequence? That's Ray being a little mean in that one. And did you give into the power of prophecy and strengthen it? So it's a reminder, right? To be like, remember your prophecy is important. And it's up to you how you want to engage with it. Like some of these questions are like, yeah, in this session, I'm going to lean into it. And in the next session, maybe not. So it's up to you. At the start of each session, you choose which question and then you can lean into it. And it's up to you when you want to change that question. So you can stick with one question for as many sessions as you like, depending on what's fun for you. And when you answer yes, you mark either XP or ruin for the impulse question, right? If you just want to get a few more ruin moves, right? You can do that.
I like the fact that the game is sort of being like, yeah, getting ruin is also fun. It feels like nothing is actually like bad for you as a character. Even the bad things are things you lean into and want to happen to you.
And it's always on your own terms, right? It was very important to me that like it's up to the players, right? On what's fun for them. So like me, for example, every time I play a Star Wars game, I'm always a Jedi that's like hurtling towards the dark side. Because that's fun for me. But other people, not so much.
I see that here as well, right? Like the idea that if you use the darkness, you'll just get what you want. Don't you want to just... Why do you want to roll and try? Why don't you just get it?
My favorite moment is always when a player is like, that's it, Ray. I'm tired of this. I'm going to use a ruin move. Like, oh, there we go.
Nice. Cool. Yeah, I think that covers it. So in session one, we'd do cats. We'd explain safety tools. We'd make characters. We'd do exactly what we just did. GM might explain the basic moves, might not, might hold off from doing that till you're in play. Also, I think that also makes sense, but you will want to explain what ruin is and conditions and stuff, right? Just to know what your character sheet is doing. But yeah, after I've made a character, what is the next thing that would happen in like a session zero? Hey, me again, interrupting. For the last time, okay, we are officially done with character creation. The next section is basically just for GMs. It's all about finishing up session zero and then gets into how to understand and run the pre-written mysteries that come with the game. These basically fulfill the same purpose as an adventure module in D&D or something like that, but they have a very different presentation. So this will hopefully hold your hand if you need it as you read them and prep to run them for the first time.
Yeah. So in a session zero, and I want to let our beloved keepers know that there's a part of the book they can refer to that's called the first session on page 187. So just to guide you on what to do. And so if there's time and if people's energy levels are still pretty high, then you can build division together. So this is just based on a few questions. For example, like, where is division located? Are there many branches or just this one?
If I wanted to say division was in the basement of the IMF, I could say that. If I wanted to say it was in Tokyo, I could say that.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes your division. And then, so you play out your day in division, right? Because like in playtesting, people were so upset. If they made the characters and started the mystery, they were like, but I want to see what division is like. So that's why we ended up doing this. But it also gives your players a chance to feel out their characters in a non-high stakes setting first, right? Like they're just feeling out, especially because it's an emotional game, right? Like you're supposed to lean into the character's emotion. So it's easier to do it from the baseline of like, this is what it's like at division. Like when you're hanging out with another agent, when you're trying to fix the coffee machine again for the nth time with your shadow control, using the shadow of the coffee machine seems to not work for some reason. And the colossal strength isn't helping. And then the last thing is introducing the mystery, right? So each keeper has a mystery that they can refer to. The book comes with quite a few to start with. My personal recommendation is to start with the Parasitic Library because it's a complexity 4 mystery. It takes place in the Division HQ basement, right? So it's a little close to home.
And just remind me what complexity means again.
Yeah. Okay, good question. So the more complex a mystery is, the more keys you need to like solve the mystery, basically. So if it's a complexity 4 mystery, it also comes with a doomsday clock that has 4 ticks, right? And basically, what the players can see is the mystery sheet, right? Where they can see the doomsday clock staring at them and how many ticks it has. But they can also see the keys that they've collected so far and the facets. So for example, the Parasitic Library, where you have to investigate this parasitic entity that has latched itself onto division and is sucking information out of it. You can tell like Josh, who wrote this mystery, is a biologist, right? But anyway, so the facets of this mystery are the Harbinger, the Door of Power, the identity of who brought the library to division, and the secrets locked within the library, right? So this is what you should try to build your theory and investigation around. And so if it's a complexity 4, right, and you want to roll with a +2, it means you need to pick up 6 keys, basically, right? So it's a little easier. A complexity 4 mystery, it depends on your players, but a complexity 4 mystery usually takes 2 to 4 sessions, right? So it's a nice way to feel out the game. Because if you start off with like a complexity 6 or 8, it can take several sessions, right? It can be like a lot of work. So I recommend the Parasitic Library to start with. And I mentioned a doomsday clock. So your players can see the clock, but only you, the keeper, can see what it means when you tick the clock. So for example, the first tick of the doomsday clock of the Parasitic Library is a flurry of loose pages swirls in a momentary storm. When the pages settle to the ground, they appear to be from different sources. And the guiding questions to help you decide what's happening is, who sees a terrible truth laid bare among the pages? Or what future event is written out here framed as an inescapable tragedy, right? So yeah, so basically when the clock ticks, it's a reminder to the players like, hey, if you don't hurry up, the Harbinger is going to get to the door. But yeah, so each mystery has like characters to meet. There are descriptions for them. They also have a list of keys that you can pick up and recontextualize. Once again, the Parasitic Library is a really good one to start with because it's stuff you can imagine in a library that you can contextualize pretty easily and how they can affect the mystery. But yeah.
So as a keeper, I'd be ticking the doomsday clock to show how close the Harbinger is to unlocking the door. And
it's up to you when you tick it. I would recommend, if this is your first time running Apocalypse Keys, just trying to tick the clock once per session, right? I usually like to do it like at the end of the session as like a cliffhanger of some kind. And then once you get used to ticking the clocks, you can maybe try to do it when it happens on a miss, or you can do it twice in a session. You can do it in the beginning or the end. I leave it up to the keeper and the players, because I find it really depends on the play group and what they prefer in terms of pacing, right?
Okay, cool. So there isn't a thing that says you have to take a clock. It's just for us to kind of signal to each other, okay, this is how close the bad guy is to unlocking the door and unleashing the apocalypse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the doomsday clock is a good way to like remind people to stay focused on the mystery, or sometimes if people pick up too many keys at once and it starts moving too quickly, you can like force a stop with the doomsday clock, force them to deal with a problem, right? Is also the goal.
Okay, so it's a pacing tool.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. So like the doomsday clock is a pacing tool. There is a section in the book that like breaks it down exactly how to use it as a pacing tool. I say this though, but the best tool is to talk to your players, right? You can just say, you know, we picked up a lot of keys. Let's focus on like interacting with the characters or figuring out the context of these keys, right? So I don't want it to replace conversation, right? But it's a way to guide the conversation.
That's fair. Because the players might be like, we're picking up keys because we really want to unlock the door this session. And then you'd be like, okay, cool. That makes sense. Let's do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so the Parasitic Library is a kind of pre-written mystery. And I guess this game is meant to be played with pre-written mysteries. What comes with the pre-written mystery?
Yeah, so with the pre-written mystery, you have a message from Division, which you read out to the players just to remind them like the premise, what's going on, what they're expected to do. And then there's a description that's for you, my dear keeper, to refer to inspire you in play. So in the Parasitic Library, for example, it's a description that talks about how scary the Parasitic Library is, how it like feeds on memories and eats people that are inside it, and so on and so forth. And then you have a set of establishing questions that connect at least one of the PCs to the mystery. So for example, one of the establishing questions for the Parasitic Library is, this is not Division's first encounter with the library. It was once used to secure something dangerous. And with its siphoning, I'm so sorry, give this biology term. With its siphonover, there you go, nature conveniently erasing all records of the mission. One of you was involved in the mission. Why are you the only one from that ill-fated team able to recall scant fragments about the catastrophe that happened, right? And you can see based on the answer, it would really shift the tone of what it is. So for example, I was asked that question during the playtest, and I said, I'm the only one who remembers because I sacrificed everyone else on my team. And I remember it. And now I have a new team to sacrifice. But other people have answered differently. And then you also have a contact. This is the first NPC that your characters will meet. So they're the most fleshed out. And they're the person who like gives you the rundown. And then the rest of their other characters, your PCs won't necessarily meet all of them, but they're all available characters for the PCs to interact with. They're written in a way that they could also possibly be the Harbinger or possibly be victims of the Harbinger. You're not sure, right? None of that is written in stone. And after the characters, you have locations of interest. So here with the library, there are different parts of the library. And it gives you ideas as a keeper to like for descriptions and what's going on. And then the most important chunk, I think, is the keys of the apocalypse. So every time you're asked to give a key, this is what... So let's going back to our example. So in this case, you're probably threatening Jen Fable, right? One of the characters. You're talking to her shadow. I realize a shadow from a parasitic library is horrible to have inside of yourself, but anyway, could be anything. And I had to connect the key to your ruin, right? To you being a harbinger. So I'm going to look at this list, right? And I recommend Keeper. Give yourself time. If you need to take a break the first few times, it's totally okay. So I'm going to pull... I'm looking at... Ooh. Fragments of a division report. One of the PC's names is cut off, right? And I'm going to say, like, the shadow whispers to you on shelf 82C is the report you're looking for, right? And then I say, like, when you reach out with your hands and open up one of the reports, you can see, like, your name along the side, right? Except it's, like, cut off. And I, as a keeper, I can, like, change aspects if I want of the key. I say it's crossed off and it's your father's name instead that's, like, written out. And then when you open up the report, it's a report of how your father fulfills the prophecy in this world if you don't do it, right? Like, if you don't break this world here, he will do it for you. Like, he's the backup plan. And as you read it, it's sanctioned by division. It's an approved tactic by division.
What does that even mean? Like, what does it mean?
What does it mean? See, the nice thing about this game is I don't have to worry about what it means. The players do. I just get to say mysterious stuff. That being said, the players will come up with an answer that's always good every time.
Yeah, 100%. I can see how this stuff will lead to, like, mysteries that feel connected to the characters. And this one especially is going to probably end up with the division looking suspicious as hell.
I mean, when I run the game, I tend to be like, you can't trust division. But other people are like, division is nice, I guess. They just take advantage of monsters sometimes, you know. They're like the lesser evil.
Like any employer.
Like any employer. Oh, that hurts. It's so true. But yeah, so you have your keys and then you have your facets, which we discussed, and the doomsday clock. But that's basically it. So you can see how, like, a mystery is a framework, right, to draw inspiration from, but it doesn't spell out what the mystery is, exactly what the PCs are doing. So I like to think of it as, like, a palette that you can draw from and attuning it to your players and the characters they've made. Because once again, like, Apocalypse Key's characters are so huge that the mysteries have to make room for them, right?
All right, that's our episode. Thank you so much for listening. A huge thank you, especially to Reina Jardi, for giving me their time and energy, especially because this was the first episode and I had so much to figure out. Also, thanks again to Diversity Saves for funding this. We have another episode coming soon. This time, we're going to be teaching a Forged in the Dark game, Girl by Moonlight, with the designer Andrew Gillis. It's a very cool episode. I'm super excited for you to see us teaching a Forged in the Dark game, especially one as cool as Girl by Moonlight. Stay tuned for that. And like I said before, this is an experiment. Let me know what you think, especially if you are somebody who's learning this game for the first time. I am really interested in whether this helped and what it could have done to help you more.
And cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonian, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.